This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Let's take a look at the home sales here in Northwest Indiana for recent months and a little look ahead as well, too. And for that matter, look back at 2019. For that, we turn to Pete Novak, who's the CEO of the Greater Northwest Indiana Association of Realtors. And Pete, thanks for joining us here on Regionally Speaking.
Oh, my pleasure, as always, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's first take a look here at the latest period. We have the numbers on here, how the home sales and the median selling prices seem to shape up here for the month of October.
Yeah, I mean, we're still seeing a fairly strong market, and the last couple of months in particular have been pretty good in general. And I think, you know, again, we're really looking at this is going to be the first year we're going to see a decrease probably in year-over-year sales, but I wouldn't look at that as necessarily a negative in terms of the housing market.
Mm-hmm.
Really, we just lack inventory. We've been saying that for quite a while, and that will be the primary reason for having less sales this year than last year. And the proof of that is that the median selling price just continues to rise pretty dramatically, not only here in Northwest Indiana, but that's really happening nationally as well.
Are we finding that we're seeing that increase because, of course, you mentioned it's the number of houses that are available, or maybe it's maybe the desirability of some of these houses?
No, we're convinced that demand remains strong, and actually this is the first time that we're seeing a market that's a little bit different locally than what is happening nationally, because nationally they're seeing house prices climb pretty dramatically as well, but I think nationally we're going to see an increase in year-over-year sales, but that won't be the case here in Northwest Indiana. We'll be on the negative side of that. And again, I just think that has everything to do with the amount of inventory that's available here in Northwest Indiana. There certainly is a shortage across the country as well, but I just think we have pretty strong demand here in Northwest Indiana.
Mm-hmm. I know that some of the latest figures, for example, here this last report in October here in Lake and in Porter counties, we've had sales of around 740, I guess, approximately for this year. That is down a little bit from last year, but it's still at least holding. The things are, you know, the markets are certainly there. It just depends on whether people are in the particular market for a particular type of house, I suppose.
It has everything to do with it, absolutely. I mean, houses that are priced accordingly and are desirable are going, you know, extremely quickly. We have less than a four-month supply of inventory. The number of total homes for sale just all across the region continue to be down from prior years, and each year it seems to get worse. But on the positive side, the home building activity has picked up quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And in 2020, it's actually projected to increase pretty substantially as well, and all of that will be good news for not only the local housing market, but the national housing market as well. As we talked about already, prices are rising pretty quickly. They have been really since about 2012. I mean, this year through the first 10 months of the year, house prices have increased over 6.5%. And that sounds great if you're a home buyer or a home seller, but not so great when you're a home buyer.
Yeah.
So that added inventory from new homes will certainly be a relief. We may even see, you know, some cooling off of prices. And I think, again, I wouldn't necessarily take that as a negative sign. I think it's just the correction in the market marketplace that needs to happen.
Are we finding, as always, that it seems to be that there's a number of homes and more homes maybe in the smaller sizes, the homes that were starters for families, 20, 30 years ago, families are leaving, they've grown up, we've got empty nesters, so to speak, now, and folks that want to sell that house because they don't have the need for, you know, three bedrooms any longer. Are we finding that these things that we've talked about in the past are still going to hold true as we go into 2020?
Well, that's been the big question. It's been a big mystery, Chris, quite frankly, for the last I think we've had an inventory shortage on existing home sales since about 2014.
Yeah.
And that just does not seem to be getting any better. Again, what the other side of the equation or a part of the equation will be new home sales, which is different than existing home sales. And, you know, obviously that in itself will give home buyers potentially more options of what's available. But in terms of existing homes that have already been built and been owned and then people put up for sale, the numbers just aren't showing at this point in time that we're seeing a ton of relief there, that we're seeing a ton of homes come back on the market. But, you know, we're expecting at some point that will change. We just don't know exactly when that'll be.
In talking with your colleagues with the home builders and the companies that actually build houses here in Northwest Indiana, are they letting you know, and you mentioned that there is some promising signs that we'll see more homes built here going into 2020 that will help kind of relieve some of the stress, I'm sure. But are we finding more subdivisions that are getting bigger these days, or at least in some locations of the area?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if bigger. I think would contend we still see less overall subdivisions than we did back in the mid-2000s. As a matter of fact, they're projecting in 2020 that there might be nationally over 1 million housing starts across the country. That's going to be the highest level since the mid-2000s. So, you know, that's also been one of the big mysteries in this positive housing market for the last 7 or 8 years, is that while the market's been very strong, what has not rebounded to normal levels has been the home building activity. So this is finally the home building activity getting back to normal levels, and I think it's surprised a lot of us in the industry that it's taken this long. But I think, you know, in 2020, this is kind of the first time where they're projecting to break that million mark. And again, that million mark, I think over 1 million probably would be traditional home building levels for the last 40 or 50 years. So I think that's pretty significant and will be a positive thing.
We're talking with Peter Novak. He's the CEO of the Greater Northwest Indiana Association of Realtors about our latest reports here on the home sales and the median selling prices here in Northwest Indiana for the association. Pete, let me ask you a question here. We see in other cities about more people that are starting to move back into urban areas and particularly in gentrified neighborhoods, so to speak. Do we find some of that trend happening in Northwest Indiana? And to go along with that question, I guess the next question that kind of fits with it is if the expansion happens the way that is planned on the South Shoreline in these transit-oriented developments, which include housing, are we going to see more people move back into these areas, especially if they're close to commuter train stations?
Well, what you're describing certainly is a national trend, and it does happen in Northwest Indiana as well, but I think clearly still in Northwest Indiana, the traffic patterns, you're still seeing a lot of the home buy activity stronger in some of the Southern Lake County markets, the Porter County markets. But I tell people all the time, if you look at some of the older housing markets in Northwest Indiana, if you look at the Hammonds, you know, some of those particular communities, they're just as strong in their own right. Like, you can't compare them apples to apples, but what you can compare them to is what their prior levels were. And those markets are just as strong. And so I think from our perspective, seeing diversity and options for people that want to, you know, live in more urban areas. And it's not just urban areas. I think when you look at the home buying activity, what's appealing to the younger generation is, you know, sort of the living opportunities in which they don't always have to use a car to get to where they're going. So whether that's public transportation or even people using recreational modes of transportation, all of that, from what we've been seeing and hearing, is getting stronger and stronger. And so I think it's important that even if it isn't happening exactly now, that we are planning for that in the future, because future home buyers are going to be desiring those amenities. And I think, you know, I think we have people that see that vision in Northwest Indiana and are trying to tackle that vision, and we're certainly, our Realtor Association has been part of that. But, you know, I don't think we in Northwest Indiana are as strong in the desire for those yet. As other communities, I think you can go into Illinois and see that desirability around some of the public transportation amenities there is very strong, and we're really trying to mimic that. So I would say we're behind, but we're certainly desiring to have some of those options available for home buyers in the future.
These are interesting things to think of as we go into 2020. As you say, the trends don't change right away, but we have plans for the future, and we know that some things are going to make some changes, and we're going to eventually see some people decide they want to live closer to the big city, but they don't want to live in the big city any longer. So these are the options. As long as the ways to get to work are there, they'll look to some other ways in the future too. So it's interesting to project these things going into the future. And thanks a lot, Pete, for offering your thoughts as well as the data coming out from the Association of Realtors about these.
My pleasure, Chris.
Peter Novak is the CEO of the Greater Northwest Indiana Association of Realtors. It's open enrollment season for the health insurance marketplace established by the Affordable Care Act, or ACA. But many people who need to sign up may not know it. The current administration's made a number of moves to diminish the law, including cuts to marketing and outreach. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports funding for navigators to help people get signed up was also slashed. But in many organizations across the Hoosier State, the job was not lost.
It's a cold fall day at the Jane Pauley Community Health Center on the east side of Indianapolis. U.S. Congressman Andre Carson is in town, hosting an event to promote open enrollment, a time when Hoosiers can sign up for health insurance or make coverage changes through the ACA.
As we approach 10 years since the passage of the Affordable Care Act, it's a great time to reflect on the successes and the millions of Americans who have received health care because of it.
About 150,000 Hoosiers get insurance through the marketplace, down from a peak of 218,000 in 2015. After a failed effort to repeal the law, the Trump administration attempted to dismantle it with other moves, including severe cuts to the advertising budget. That means Hoosiers may not even know about open enrollment or have help signing up.
Not only has the funding for advertising been cut, but also average health care premiums have increased by over $2,300.
Prices are up some, especially for Hoosiers who don't qualify for premium subsidy discounts offered through the ACA. But most will. Darlene Lopez retired this past summer. Too young for Medicare, she wasn't sure where to turn for health insurance. The unemployment office couldn't help her. Social Security told her to call 211, where they provided her a list of places that may help, including the Jane Pauley Community Health Center.
I walked through the door, and Charisse was standing there. And she's helped me so much with the process, the whole painful process.
Charisse Harris is a navigator. She says Lopez is not alone in not knowing and not understanding her options.
A lot of people are there unaware of what's out there. A lot of people are scared of the marketplace because they're hearing that the prices are not affordable. But actually with Ms. Lopez, it was affordable for her. And actually for 2020, it even went down even more for her.
Organizations like community health centers and hospitals have retained and even brought on more navigators, despite a more than 80% cut in federal funding for the positions since 2016. Covering Kids and Families of Indiana, a nonprofit that helps people with health coverage, staffs navigators. Mark Fairchild is policy director with the group and says the position is vital.
They know the ins and outs. They know the process. They've seen 100 of these applications, whereas for a consumer, it's probably their first one, and it looks very, very daunting. And they walk you through that process step by step.
This year, all 92 counties will be able to pick from plans provided by at least two companies. But there's a lot of variety in the plan options. There was also a federal push to increase short-term or so-called junk plans that don't have to comply with ACA standards, including covering pre-existing conditions. People can get confused easily, says Fairchild.
And as much as I'm in this line of work, I don't always understand my insurance, right? If we're being honest, most people really don't know all those ins and outs. There's a lot of jargon, a lot of legal terminology, a lot of things you could do wrong to be denied coverage, even if you perfectly well qualify for it.
Many states have adopted measures to strengthen the ACA. Indiana is one of the states that have done the least to preserve the health law. But Fairchild says, despite the cuts, repeal of the individual mandate, and other moves to weaken the ACA, the marketplace has proven resilient.
A lot of what the Affordable Care Act really sought out to do, which was to get people covered and get them used to the benefits of coverage, has stuck around.
Getting people used to having insurance and the peace of mind that comes with it. Darlene Lopez says she isn't the only one that needs help signing up.
I'm not alone in this. You know, other people retire. People lose their jobs.
Open enrollment for the marketplace ends December 15th. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
This is Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. Here on Regionally Speaking, it's time now for Building Northwest Indiana. And here's your host, Kevin Comerford.
So welcome to today's episode of Building Northwest Indiana Radio. My name is Kevin Comerford. I am the Director of Professional Development at the Construction Advancement Foundation of Northwest Indiana, and I will be your host today. The purpose of Building Northwest Indiana Radio is to provide you with a little insight into the Northwest Indiana professional construction industry. Today, we will be talking about the Carpenter's Apprenticeship Program as well as the application process. My guest today is Chris Charters. Chris is a journeyman carpenter, and he's a native of Lowell, Indiana, and currently serves as the Career Connection Outreach Specialist for the Indiana, Kentucky, Ohio Regional Council of Carpenters. Chris, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, Kevin. Thanks for inviting me.
What exactly is a carpenter? I know you guys, you specialize in a lot of different aspects of the trade, but what exactly does a carpenter do on a day-to-day basis?
Well, I think the most common reply to what is a carpenter, everybody thinks, is that a carpenter grabs a hammer, drives nails, builds a housing. Yes, carpenters do that, but on a much broader scale than that, the carpenter's umbrella is quite huge. Basically, a carpenter takes any kind of drawings or blueprints that are made by architects, and we turn those into structures, right? So whether they're schools, hospitals, residences, or any kind of commercial retail development, that's what we do.
You brought a good point up. I mean, I talk to a lot of students sometimes, and you know, when they think of carpenters, they think residential, but I mean, you guys are heavily involved in industrial, heavy highway, heavy commercial. Can you talk about maybe some of the things that you do more on an industrial level?
In the industrial level, the majority of what we do there are, they might be heavy highway bridges or a lot of scaffolding work. Our scaffold builders in this area are the best in the country, and a lot of those guys travel the country doing scaffold work. The industrial work for us is based on working in the mills or the refineries that are in our areas, so, even NIPSCO plants that are across the country and electrical generation plants that are out there that are doing repair work.
Let's kind of switch directions here and talk a little bit about your apprenticeship program. Can you talk a little bit about your program, how it's designed, how many years is the apprenticeship program, things like that?
The apprenticeship program is a four-year program. Even though we say it's 4 years, it's an earn while you learn program. The applicant would apply to the apprenticeship, and when accepted, the great thing about that is there's no cost to it. So if you're accepted into our program, you come 4 times a year. Those 4 times a year consist of a Monday through Friday, 1 week, 8 hours a day. So it's 40 hours for that week. 3 months later, you come back for another week. Well, you do that 4 times throughout the year, and you do that for 4 years. The great thing about that is while you're not at the training center, we're not building you and teaching you and giving you those hands-on skill sets, you're out in the field. And when you're out in the field, you're earning that great wage.
And I know some of the other trades offer this. Do you have a partnership with Ivy Tech? Because I think a lot of the other trades offer a degree upon successful completion of the apprenticeship program. Do the carpenters offer something similar?
We do, and we are in a partnership with Ivy Tech. Every one of our courses that we take, that we offer, that the apprentices take at our training center throughout their four-year apprenticeship program, have college credits rated to them, ranked with their curriculum. And they test out of those things. Those test scores go directly to Ivy Tech. At the end of the apprenticeship, not only do they become a journeyman carpenter, but they also have earned an associate's degree in applied science through Ivy Tech.
Let's talk about pay, because I'm sure a lot of people are interested about pay. How does that work while you're an apprentice? Do you start off at a higher wage, or do you start off at a lower wage and then work your way up as you go through the program?
Obviously, as an apprentice, you're going to start off at a lower wage, and you're going to work your way through the apprenticeship program. The goal is for us to make that money. That's what our return on our investment is. We're going to invest our time in training, and you're going to invest your time as an apprentice to be trained and develop those skill sets. As you work through the apprenticeship program, our first-year apprentices are starting out at about $20.86 an hour. Not only are they receiving that great wage, but they're getting a benefit package that comes along with that as soon as they become a first-year apprentice. They're getting those health care benefits. They're getting a pension plan paid into. They're getting an annuity plan paid into. And that's going to be there for them when they retire. Every year that they work up from a first-year to a second-year apprentice, without getting into a lot of detail, it's about a $4 an hour pay raise every year that they work through the apprenticeship.
How about benefit packages? Is there a benefit package that the apprentice gets, or do they have to wait till they're finished with the apprenticeship program?
No, they do start receiving those benefits as soon as they become a first-year apprentice. They start receiving those health care benefits. And the health care benefits that the apprentice receives are the same as what our journeyman carpenters receive. The same dollar amount gets paid into there. It's good for the apprentice. It's good for the journeyman. It's good for their spouse and their kids. So it's a family plan that they can then use when it's needed. They are getting a pension dollar amount paid into. The apprentices start off at a little bit less dollar amount that goes into their pension, and when they become a journeyman, then they go up to the journeyman amount for their pension plan.
So how would somebody get involved in becoming a carpenter? How do you fill out the application?
The application process is really easy. Come into our building in Merrillville. That's our training center that's in this area. You walk in and you just ask to fill out an application. Fill it out while you're at the facility. And there are some required documents that you need to have for that. So some of the requirements that go with that is that you need to have a high school diploma or a GED. You need to bring in your high school transcripts with you. You need to have a valid driver's license or a state ID. We're going to photocopy that as well. And then we're going to ask you to formulate a one-page resume. It doesn't have to be anything extravagant, just a simple one-page resume. So those are some of the documents that we require, and then you fill out the application, and we put it on file there at the training center.
That'll do it for today's edition of Building Northwest Indiana Radio. I would like to thank our guest today, Chris Charters, Career Connections Outreach Specialist for the Indiana-Kentucky-Ohio Regional Council of Carpenters. To find out more information about the Carpenters or how to apply for their apprenticeship program, you can visit ikorcctraining.com.
Support for Building Northwest Indiana comes from the Construction Advancement Foundation. You can hear Building Northwest Indiana on Tuesdays here on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. And the podcasts are also online as well at lakeshorepublicradio.org. The American Lung Association is asking the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to crack down on vaping companies who claim their products are quit smoking aids. Dr. David Hill is the Director of Clinical Research at Waterbury Pulmonary Associates in Connecticut, and he's also the Assistant Clinical Professor of Medicine at Yale University and is on the National Board for the American Lung Association. Dr. Hill spoke with Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson recently about what his advocacy group is doing on behalf of people who are trying to quit smoking.
So tell me about the American Lung Association, what it's asking of the FDA in relation to e-cigarettes.
So we're asking a couple of things of the FDA. We are asking the FDA to enforce their responsibility to review and regulate e-cigarettes, which is their mandate, and to remove from the marketplace those tobacco products that pose the greatest health risks, particularly ones that are targeted at children and teenagers. As part of this, we are urging the FDA to take meaningful action to regulate the marketing of and manufacture of e-cigarettes, which would include removing of all flavored tobacco products on the market, including menthol cigarettes, flavored smokeless tobacco, flavored cigars, and flavored e-cigarettes.
And have you gotten a response from them? Have you made the ask already?
Yes, we have been repeatedly asking for this. The FDA has delayed taking action. The current administration initially said they would support a ban on flavored vaping, but more recently has backed off from that decision.
Why have they backed off?
Well, according to recent reports in the press, this was due to concerns on the effects on jobs and particularly on votes in swing states.
So they're afraid that if they try to take e-cigarettes off the market, it's going to affect votes for them?
That's what was reported, that pro-vaping proponents would be voting against those who attempted to regulate the products.
So how are you going to go about it now?
Well, we're going to continue to urge the FDA to do what is their responsibility, which is to make these products safe or remove them from the market, and continue to work with our advocates and other organizations to continue to pressure the administration, because people who are concerned about what they breathe and about their children's health are also voters.
Can you tell us about what has been going on? There's been a lot of stories out there about kids who have died from using e-cigarettes.
So this is the danger of an unregulated marketplace. Right now, anyone can sell anything in a e-cigarette or vaping product because no one is monitoring what is being put in these devices. The recent reported epidemic of what's being called E-Valley, electronic vaping-induced acute lung injury, is very concerning. Obviously, there have been severe illnesses, including death, primarily in youth and young adults. And this may be due to a variety of substances. The FDA and the CDC are still investigating the exact causes of this, but the danger is products are being marketed to young people that are not safe, nor are they effective as a smoking cessation aid. So the acute lung injury is one concern, but there are potentials for long-term health effects that we can't detect as quickly as the more severe injury.
How many people have died from e-cigarettes so far in these acute lung injuries?
So I would have to look at the most recent CDC data, which, if you forgive me, I'm going to look it up right now. It's the advantage of having the internet directly in front of you.
I agree.
So as of November 13th, there have been 42 deaths confirmed in 24 states in the District of Columbia, with vaping-induced lung injury reported in every state except Alaska, and also it has been reported in Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands.
Does it have any breakdown of states in there, and do you see Indiana?
Let me see. So for Indiana, there have been between 50 and 99 cases reported.
Of deaths or just cases?
Let me see it. Those were cases. I don't see deaths broken down by state.
So you want the FDA to crack down on vaping companies who claim that their products are quit smoking products that are being said to aid people to quit smoking?
Yes. So we feel, one, obviously quitting smoking is hard, but e-cigarettes and vaping have made it even more confusing for smokers. These products do not aid people in stopping their nicotine addiction. They're just switching from combustible tobacco products to e-cigarettes, and we feel that switching is not quitting. We have decades of experience in successfully helping smokers quit using proven methods such as counseling and FDA-approved medications, and that's how people who are addicted to nicotine and tobacco products should attempt to achieve smoking cessation.
Do you have any idea of vaping companies in Indiana or even Northwest Indiana that are claiming that their e-cigarettes are quit smoking products?
I don't have specific data for those locations. I will tell you that vaping retailers are found just about everywhere. The products, a lot of them are manufactured overseas, which makes regulation even more difficult, but it's, a danger.
What is the substance that's in those devices, in the e-cigarettes? E-cigarettes and vaping, is that the same thing?
The terms can be confusing. Essentially, e-cigarettes and vaping devices are a variety of devices that typically use a heating element to vaporize whatever is being inhaled. That can include nicotine. It can include cannabinoids, marijuana, and CBD oils. It can include a lot of potentially harmful substances, including propylene glycol, vegetable glycerin, various toxins that are known to cause lung disease, even in small amounts. And the problem is that right now there is no regulation. Someone buying an e-cigarette or vaping product really has no idea what they're inhaling, nor how much nicotine a nicotine-containing e-cigarette may have.
Tell me about the Quit, Don't Switch campaign.
We feel that switching to e-cigarettes does not mean quitting. And there has been a false narrative that states that e-cigarettes are effective in helping people quit smoking in comparison to other FDA-approved forms of smoking cessation. There was a large study published in the New England Journal which showed that people who used e-cigarettes were more likely to stop smoking cigarettes than those who used nicotine replacement. However, in that study, 90% of the smokers who were on nicotine replacement therapy quit nicotine addiction entirely, whereas 80% of the smokers on e-cigarettes continued to use e-cigarettes, leaving them addicted to nicotine and giving them the potential to return to conventional cigarettes at any time. We're really trying to educate smokers and the public that the best way to stop your nicotine addiction is to stop using nicotine products in the long run.
That's Dr. David Hill. He's a national board member for the American Lung Association, speaking recently with Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson. Republican state lawmaker Todd Houston of Fishers in central Indiana will be the next speaker of the Indiana House of Representatives. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports that Houston's GOP colleagues named him the heir apparent to retiring House Speaker Brian Bosma at a private meeting yesterday.
Houston will serve alongside Bosma in the 2020 session as Speaker-elect, learning on the job before Bosma retires. Houston says he's grateful and thankful to take on the job.
The core fundamentals of running a house that runs functionally, that we deal with each other in a respectful manner, all those things, I think from an outside perspective, I hope look very, very largely the same.
Bosma says he's confident the state is in good hands with Houston's leadership.
That important stability, I think, is really critical. And I am very confident that Representative Houston is going to bring that same sense of stability.
Houston is a senior vice president at the College Board, which administers the SAT. He previously served as chief of staff to controversial state superintendent Tony Bennett. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You notice lately the number of seniors that are returning to the workforce. Well, there's some more indications about this. And how does it fit in with the overall scheme of retirement? Well, let's find out more from Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer. He's with us always here on Lakeshore Public Radio. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, let's start out first with talking first about the facts about the fact we have more senior workers in the workforce than we probably ever have, haven't we?
Yeah, we do. And, you know, a lot of that, Chris, I think is a reflection of, you know, the fact that people are living longer, number one. So retirement has been stretched out from, you know, what used to be typically 10, 15 years to, you know, more of the 20, 25, even 30 years for a lot of people. And, you know, a lot of your benefits, even Social Security, are the full benefits are being pushed back later. And I think the result is you're seeing, the population begin to age that or before you begin retirement.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the tips that you can pass along to us and tell us about, if we're not aware of, to make sure that we are ready for retirement if we're at that age or approaching that age?
Well, I think first, the government's realizing that they need to do something to allow people to catch up, you know, to put more money towards retirement. And the catch-up provisions continue to increase within our normal retirement vehicles like the 401Ks and the IRAs. And those catch-up provisions have increased again this year. You know, for the 401K, you have your standard $19,000 for everybody, but the 50 and over can now contribute an additional $6,000 in contributions to the 401K. And the IRA has gone up to $6,000, and you have a catch-up provision of $1,000.
Mm-hmm. How about looking ahead for, I guess, if we haven't set up a strategy or taken advantage of the ones that are out there to be able to use our tax dollars the best?
Well, I think the biggest thing today is the new tax laws have really created some unique opportunities that just simply didn't exist prior to these tax laws in terms of which strategies would be the best. And with the tax implications and the rates being as low as they are, the non-taxable contributions like the Roth can be a lot more advantageous than they have been in the past and can help diversify those assets that are sitting in retirement.
And we talked about this before, of course, about trying to plan ahead and literally, in this case, creating an income plan if you don't have one, right?
Well, I think ultimately we've talked about this many times, Chris. It has to start with the end in mind. And, you know, it's a common phrase that people have heard, but it's kind of hard to get to where you want to go if you don't know exactly what it is you want in retirement or where it is you want to end up. And,
yeah.
And the income plan is first and foremost that map, you know, that guideline. Okay, where is it that I want to go? What are the things I can do? And then actively work on it to constantly improve that plan and try to avoid costly mistakes, but, you know, give you a better idea of what the target is. What do I need to have set aside? What type of assets do I have to have? Where do they have to be in order to accomplish my goals?
Now, for folks that are in retirement or approaching retirement, and they are maybe trying to get things planned out as they can, but, of course, they're looking ahead to try and decide, well, do I really want to work? Do I want to officially retire, or do I want to continue to work into my retirement year, so to speak? But there's some things that you need to think about, and I know that there are three in particular that you bring up often. Let's bring those up, please.
Sure. I mean, the first thing is, you know, how you envision your retirement. And a lot of folks, they don't like idle time. You know, they've been active their entire careers. They've worked, you know, constantly and consistently their entire careers. And, you know, they feel like, you know, if I continue to work, it's just something that they would enjoy doing, something that they, you know, would feel fit in well with their retirement. But it's a second career that it's something that they enjoy to do. And they have fun doing it, you know, and it adds the additional income.
Mm-hmm.
I think also, you know, part of it is, you know, most people, when they retire, we typically find that the first 5, 8, maybe 10 years of retirement generally are going to have a lot more bucket list items being accomplished, so to speak.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so the nest egg might satisfy their retirement lifestyle, but even with the sizable nest egg, a lot of times they just want to, you know, add to that nest egg for some of the things that they like to do. The key is if you're going to do that, is whatever am I doing, does it give me the flexibility to still maintain, you know, what I see my retirement? So how you envision your retirement is a solely focused on pastimes? Is it focused on grandkids? Is it focused on, you know, just hanging out and relaxing? Whatever it might be, you need to envision that structure that keeps you busy, and working retirement may be a fit, you know, if you want a more active retirement.
Now, I suppose, too, for example, if you're a businessman and you've decided to step aside from the business or the industry that you happen to have been business in, but you still want to participate and help out with many organizations, in particular like those that are out there that help new businesses get started, get some of their problems resolved, because you have the experience you can put to it. You may not necessarily get paid, but you need to kind of plan ahead if you do want to be able to do that kind of volunteer work and still be able to pay for everything, right?
Absolutely. And, yeah. And again, we sound like a broken record sometimes, but it always goes back to, you know, what's my plan? You know, yeah. Not only the income plan, that income plan really needs to incorporate, you know, how do I envision my retirement? What do I see it as? You know, what are the things I want to do? How do I want to spend my time? You know, we've done what we had to up to that point. Now it's more or less, you know, what do I want to do? And there's a big difference, I tell people, between having and wanting, right? If I want to do some things and maybe I have some passions, I have a lot of friends that have gone through their career, and they might have a charitable interest in mind to say, hey, my passion in retirement, and I want to stay active. I want to figure out how to, you know, create this type of fundraising for this particular organization, or I want to spend time, you know, working in this personal arena because it's something I've always wanted to do, but it couldn't support what I needed to have, you know, during my working years.
That's Northwest Indiana Financial Advisor Greg Hammer. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. We'll be back with you tomorrow.